foggy day in Old Stillwater Town. At least it was earlier this morning. My goodness, got to the crest of the hill here, coming in from the west, and goodness sakes, kind of a pea super in parts by Highway 36 and Osgood Avenue and a little bit down the hill, but I think that's all burned off right now. So we can say to you, in clear conscience and clear weather, good afternoon and welcome to the Stan Turner Show. So happy to have you on board. Thanks for being with us here. We have a most interesting hour for you. I'll let that unfold in just a second here. But first, Kyle, our great producer, how you doing, my friend?
I cannot complain this morning.
Did you get through the fog this morning? You're going to tell me you didn't see any, right?
No, I did have to cut through it quite a bit.
Yeah, it was pretty rough.
Yeah.
Wasn't expecting that, but it should be okay by now. We're looking at some good weather down toward the rest of the week. I might get to that as we go on here. But boy, big doings here in Stillwater today. It's the Harvest Fest. Well, of course, celebrating the fall colors, the region's giant pumpkin weigh-in. That's going on over here right in Lowell Park, Kyle, right along the riverfront. Growers from the region bring pumpkins weighing 1,500 pounds or more. They have a big crane they use to weigh them over here. There'll be a tasting contest, a beer tasting contest, and wine. Great pumpkin boat race on the St. Croix River. A tractor pull this weekend. Live music, street dancing, haunted caves tours. Kids activities, lots going on today and tomorrow. Lowell Park, that's the stretch right along the river here in downtown Stillwater. And it's right next to the historic lift bridge. So that should locate it for you pretty well. So come on down. Fun day. So, Kyle, after the show, go over there and watch them weigh in that pumpkin. Maybe 2,000 pounds, huh?
Yeah, that's impressive.
Don't let that thing fall on you, boy.
Oh, no.
No. Okay. We're at 12:08 right now. You heard the weatherman, 48 degrees, heading for highs today in the upper 50s. Before we get into the main event of our program, I want to offer a brief remembrance and appreciation of a very special guy, very special friend, very special journalist. Mike Simonson passed away suddenly this past Sunday in Duluth. Mike joined Wisconsin Public Radio in 1990, the first reporter in the then newly opened Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior. Mike was a terrific guy. He was totally devoted to journalism, had no ego problems whatsoever. He was in journalism to find, disseminate, process, and distribute information so that we'd all be a bit wiser about what's going on in our lives. Mike Simonson's work regularly received regional and even national recognition. His 2012 radio documentary called Forever Ace, The Richard Bong Story. Well, that won both a National Headliner Award and an Associated Press Award. That was about Richard Bong, the World War II fighter ace in the Pacific. He was the highest scoring fighter ace in the Pacific Theater of Operations in World War II, and he happened to come from Poplar, Wisconsin, which is very near Superior, Wisconsin. Mike Simonson spent about 10 years gathering information, did interviews of people who knew Dick Bong, who was killed in a post-war flying accident, but Mike did a sterling job on that, typical of his work. Superior Regional News Manager John Munson put it this way: journalism wasn't just a job for Mike Simonson, it was a passion. And I remember this, when the astronaut and Wisconsin native Colonel Jeffrey Williams was launched into space from Kazakhstan in, I think it was 1992, Mike was so intent, now it was later than that, Mike was so intent on covering the story that he flew to the remote Central Asian nation at his own expense to cover the story. He did that. Amazing. You talk about a passion, no doubt about it. And I love these words from one of Mike's students. He was a mentor to students at the University of Wisconsin and other schools in the Northland up there. Aaron Brown had this to say on Mike after his passing: if you went into radio with unanswered questions, excuses, sloppy copy, or a hint of mush, he'd mark up your script and scrawl the names of three more people to call to get the story right. You would stay until it was done. Mike taught a legion of students this way. They work across the country now in journalism. Isn't that nice? And he said, Aaron Brown said of Mike Simonson, big man, big voice, big heart. Endless loyalty and devotion to his former students and listeners, and went on to do much more than we could have without him. Well, there's another good guy gone too soon. Mike Simonson, rest in peace. 12:11 right now. Yep, 48 degrees. And folks, let's get to the main business at hand here today, this Saturday noon. You know, we're sitting on one right here. River valleys are pretty easy to love, aren't they? River valleys, especially the towns that are situated on the river. They have a charm, call it a magic, that's hard to duplicate. Wisconsin and Minnesota have a wealth of beautiful river valley towns. Red Wing is one of them. Not a very long drive south and east from the Twin Cities to Red Wing. And if you walk down the hill from Red Wing's St. James Hotel, you come to Levee Park, which runs along the Mississippi River. Lovely place. You see watercraft, beautiful trees and shrubs and flowers. The grounds are beautifully manicured. And you see the bends in the Mississippi River. Then you likely notice a large stone with two metal tablets or plaques on it. Reading the words, the story on those plaques change your mood from serene to solemn in very short order. The plaques tell of a river disaster in 1890, one that shocked the Midwest and the nation. It came to be known as the Sea Wing disaster. It's possibly the most famous Minnesota-Wisconsin tragedy that most people have never heard of. This noon, we shine some much-needed light on that dark moment 124 years ago. The Sea Wing was an excursion boat loaded with crew and passengers. Those passengers were day trippers out for a pleasure cruise on a hot summer Sunday. Before the day was out, nearly 100 people on that boat, many from Red Wing, were dead. What happened? Who or what was to blame? Was it preventable? What was the aftermath, and how did it change so many lives? In studio this noon, we have the man who can answer those questions and many more. Frederick L. Johnson is a superb historian, researcher, and author who has put together a full-scale account of the Sea Wing disaster. His book is titled The Sea Wing Disaster: Tragedy on Lake Pepin. Frederick, we'll call him Fred during this radio chat today, lives in the Twin Cities metro area. Fred, welcome and thanks for doing this work, getting this book together and giving this sad event the attention it deserves. Great job.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, good. I heard you about, was it 2 weeks ago down here in Stillwater? You addressed
Yes.
the Washington County Historical Society, gave us an overview of the Sea Wing disaster. People were spellbound, and I'm guessing a lot of people in that room, and mind you, our members of the Historical Society knew very little, if anything, about this event. How can that happen? You know, in Minnesota here, Wisconsin, we remember the Hinckley Fire of 1894. Of course, 400 poor souls plus died than that, and there have been other things more recently, the 35W bridge collapse. We remember all those things. Why does the Sea Wing disaster just kind of go off in the fog? What is it? Why did it get forgotten so quickly?
Well, after researching it and actually kind of semi-living through it, I have relatives, family relatives who were on the boat, so there's a personal part of that story for me. When I was researching, I discovered very little information on the Sea Wing. At the Minnesota Historical Society, there was only a memorial booklet. That's the only trace of it.
The only thing.
When I started looking, that was in the 1980s.
That's amazing.
So when we continued the work...
Wait a minute, 98 people died that day.
98 people died. This was, as you pointed out, a national story, and, yes. and really big in the Midwest, the Upper Mississippi Valley. But what happened, in my opinion, is it was so localized to the Red Wing Lake City area. 77 of the 98 people who died were from Red Wing. That story clobbered that town so bad. In the newspapers, Twin City newspapers, it was called the City of the Dead mm-hmm. in summer of 1890, mm-hmm. and it was for good reason. Mm-hmm. So I'm feeling that the story, of course, lived on in Red Wing. Mm-hmm. It was a week-long story. Mm-hmm. in the national press and locally, and then it petered out there, but it was never forgotten by Red Wing.
Fred, I'm a history buff, you know that. And when I go to Levee Park and Red Wing and see that that cairn, that stone with the tablets on it, I'm ashamed, or at least not anymore, but when I say, I should know more about this. Why don't I? So I dutifully read the plaque and the names of the dead from Red Wing there and say, I've got to get going on this. But I couldn't find anything. You did do an article back in the 80s on this, didn't you? An article I never saw.
I did an article for Minnesota History, and I also did originally a small book on the Sea Wing disaster that at that point was really the only full account of the Sea Wing disaster.
You know, it's interesting. The more we talk about this, and now with your full-scale book out here, The Sea Wing Disaster Tragedy on Lake Pepin, there's no doubt that people listening right now will say, oh, I think I had a grandfather or a great-grandfather or a great-aunt who was on that boat, and I think I've got some letters here from some other relatives about that, and this is how this thing's kind of like an onion skin, right? The layers come off and off and off, and you get more and more information as you go on.
You are right. That happened right here in Stillwater. Two people came up to me after I gave my talk, mentioning relations, family relationships that they had to people on the Sea Wing, survivors or victims.
All right. Well, this whole tragedy poses tons of questions, which you address and answer in your book. I think we want to walk our friends, our listeners, through this today.
Sure.
Again, this terrible thing happened on July 13th, 1890, and it happened down in what we call Lake Pepin, which is really a bulge in the Mississippi River at Lake City, isn't it?
It's a good description of it. It's about 4 miles wide.
Right. The river widens out down there. And this, as I said in the introduction, was a day to be filled with joy and fun. It was a Sunday. Set the stage for us here. First of all, the Sea Wing itself, what kind of craft was this? What kind of boat was it?
It was a small steamboat. It was a work boat. Mainly, it did lumber rafting or timber rafting on the Mississippi and St. Croix. Mm-hmm. And when there were special occasions, the owner and captain of the boat, David Weatherin, would run excursions and make a little extra money. In this case, there was an excursion planned for a visit to the Lake City headquarters of the Minnesota National Guard, the summer headquarters at Camp Lakeview.
Okay.
And Captain David Weatherin came about this idea and managed to attach a barge to the front of the boat so he'd have room for more passengers.
Before you go on, that's an odd configuration. Here you've got a steamboat, and in this case kind of an excursion boat, and you lash a barge to the left front bow. I've never seen that done. You'll push it or you'll pull it pull it from behind. But this barge was lashed to the front left, the port side.
It was, and sometimes you'd find excursions with barges attached to both front.
Didn't know that.
Port and barge. So in this case, it was, as you say, on the port side, and it allowed him to take probably another 75 people on board. After the accident and the records were analyzed, we know that there were about 215 people on this small riverboat, 135 feet long, only 16 feet wide. It's 22 feet high, very top-heavy.
Well, top-heavy. Does that have another way of saying it was unstable? Potentially unstable?
Unstable, yeah. Right. Normally, you're not going to have to worry much about heavy weather on the inland waters of America.
And this was a flat-bottom boat?
Totally flat-bottom, right.
Okay.
So you could usually depend on the fact that you are flat-bottomed, and if there's a problem on the river, you just steam to shore, run it right up on the land, and you'll be fine.
All right, well, the day starts. This is a Sunday. It is a hot and a humid, a sweltering summer day, isn't it, Sunday?
Right.
And here's this boat, and I think it pulls, it was based, basically, wasn't it, in Diamond Bluff, Wisconsin?
That's correct. Weatherin was from Diamond Bluff.
That's a little bit north of Stillwater, upriver from Stillwater, right? From Red Wing, I'm sorry, Red Wing.
From Red Wing, correct. A short trip, about 20 minutes boat ride.
From Red Wing, okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so the voyage starts there.
It starts there.
In the morning.
They had about, after picking up a few people, family relations to crew members.
Including the captain's.
And the captain's family. The captain had his wife and two sons on board.
Right.
Then they came to Red Wing because I mentioned Camp Lakeview. Red Wing's Company D of the Minnesota 1st Regiment was at Camp Lakeview, and they were having kind of an open house down there.
Ah, I see.
They were going to be demonstrations of cannon fire and rifle marksmanship and marching and a band. It was really a time for people to come down and see what the guard was up to.
Okay, okay.
So he knew he would get a lot of people at Red Wing.
Okay, well, that was good planning on his part, then.
It was.
So Diamond Bluff, and then the boat actually goes to another Wisconsin stopover, Trenton, doesn't
Trenton
it?
Trenton is just
picks up some more people there.
That's correct.
Then over to Red Wing, and most of the people get on there.
Right.
That's the bulk of them get on there. Okay, and before we move ahead here, there was an itinerary. You write about this in your book, The Sea Wing Disaster, Tragedy on Lake Pepin. Before we go on, you've got to tell us about a preacher, an itinerant preacher, I believe. Was he in Diamond Bluff? Was he in that town?
He was, right. He was Greek, we only know his last name is Georges.
Okay.
And he was staying with the Niles family, a very prominent family who happened to have four sons on the crew of the Sea Wayne.
Okay. Right.
So we know the story is pretty reliable.
Right.
Edmund Niles told the story of him staying with them, and on the day of the accident, he was at the riverside telling people, don't get on the boat.
The preacher is going around saying, don't go on this cruise.
His main contention was, first, it's Sunday, you shouldn't be going on a cruise.
Okay.
And second, he had a prediction. He said the boat is going to sink.
Had a premonition?
That's what he seemed to be saying to them. He said
flat out the boat's going to sink?
Right. And that actually got a few people off the boat.
Really?
Not
they
many,
opted not to go?
Yes.
Wow. Wow.
And then he drifts away out of history. I would thought he might want to come back to
say, I told you so?
Yeah, exactly. But he did not.
That's amazing.
It's the last we heard of him.
That sends chills up one's spine, doesn't it?
It does, I mean, considering what happened.
And this was no joke. This guy was going around saying, this thing is going to go down. This boat's going to sink. Don't go near it.
Exactly.
Wow. We're going to take a break here. We're talking with, visiting with Frederick Johnson. We're calling him Fred here, Frederick L. Johnson, a great author and historian here. His book, The Sea Wing Disaster, Tragedy on Lake Pepin, a story of tragedy from the 1890 summer. This is an amazing story. Finally, it's being well told, fully told by this wonderful gentleman, Mr. Johnson. We're going to take a break. We'll continue with our story, The Odyssey of the Sea Wing and the Tragedy on Lake Pepin, right after this. Valley Bookseller invites you to the store on Sunday, October 12th at 11 a.m. to meet Connie Kingray Anderson. She's the author of The Creeper's Mysteries. There's a rumor of an Ebenezer Stump sighting, and we'll gather around the lantern and read A Creeper's Mystery. You can star in your own movie for the ear using the script in the back of the book. Activities, treats, prizes, and more. Call 651-430-3385. Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. Located at 217 Main Street North in Stillwater.
We've been family owned since 1922, and we still believe that it all starts with you.
Luxurious, distinctive, serene, sculpted. That's the 2014 Buick Verano from Stillwater Motors. And now, the Buick Verano is more affordable than ever. For a limited time, you can save up to $7,000 on the Verano, or lease it for just $298 a month with a $1,500 down payment. It's the car that won't break the bank. The Verano features available heated leather seats, quiet tuning cabin technology, and premium safety technologies that include side blind zone alert and rear cross traffic alert. Even better, the Buick Verano gets up to 32 miles per gallon. Find out more about Consumer Guide's 2014 Automotive Best Buy. The 2014 Buick Verano at Stillwater Motors, located at Highway 36 and Stillwater Boulevard, right on the corner, right on the price, and online at stillwatermotors.com. Redun's family owned and operated since 1922.
Stillwater Motors, good people to know.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.com.
And we are back here. We continue our story of the Sea Wing disaster tragedy on Lake Pepin, something that so few people know about, but they will now, thanks to a new book by Frederick L. Johnson, a local historian, author, great researcher here. The book is in bookstores now. You can pick it up. Fred, it's available, I think, just about everywhere, isn't it now?
Not as much as I would like to see.
I think the best way
to get it right now is down along the river, on both sides of Lake Pepin and in Red Wing, Lake City, and also the Goodyear County Historical Society.
And we want it here at Valley Bookseller for sure in Stillwater, one of our esteemed sponsors on this radio station. And those ladies who run that shop are first-class book people. And I know if they don't have it here, folks, go ahead, order it through Valley Bookseller. The Sea Wing Disaster.
They'll be able to get it.
They will. Frederick L. Johnson. Okay, we just before the break, Fred, we were talking about this itinerant preacher who sadly predicted the demise of the excursion boat that hot July Sunday in 1890. It did go down. The boat swung over to Red Wing, picked up most of the passengers, then headed down to Lake City for what was intended to be a day of excitement and joy, and set the stage for us as far as the weather goes. What was it like? We have some pretty accurate information about what was going on that day.
Yeah, we do have good weather reports. In fact, there was a weather system that had been kind of lingering in the area, and hot and humid was the way it had been. There had been a couple of breaks in this front, but then it would kind of drift back into that weather Minnesotans know, those sticky days midsummer.
We know them.
But getting on a riverboat, taking a little river cruise, is going to help, you know, make all the difference for you. Let's try that. No problem.
Or so you thought. So a stifling day, and it got hotter and warmer and more humid as the day wore on. And up here in the Twin Cities, the first not so subtle notice of how potentially violent the system became or did become happened in around Lake Jervis. Is that right?
Right,
north of St. Paul.
Yep, just 6 miles north of St. Paul. It was
a resort.
Of day? It was in about 4 in the afternoon,
right.
And a tornado ripped through Lake Jervis and killed 5 people. Another 22 were hurt. It was a major problem. Of course, people down in Lake City and the Sea Wing, captain and crew and passengers had no knowledge of that.
Yeah, suffice it to say, no cell phones, no internet, no nothing, and no real weather service in this country.
And you can think of what would have happened today, how that would have been covered, because that storm drifted all the way to Stillwater, and it kind of went south through Denmark Township in Washington County and down to Hastings. And it also, of course, kind of was bringing more tempest with it as it grew.
It seemed to gather strength. It was a tornado here, Lake Jervis, but as it went south, we were getting these vicious downbursts and straight line winds too, right?
So that would be developing a little later, but there were, at Camp Lakeview, there was a storm with wind and rain that really broke up festivities down there. The activities that were planned right at about 4:30. It was not a tornado, and it wasn't a straight line wind yet, but it was a wind enough to mess everything up and scatter the crowd.
Before the storm hit, let's get a picture in our minds of what the people were doing on board the excursion boat and the attached barge. Today people would show up for an event like this in shorts and tank tops and that kind of thing, and sandals and flip-flops, whatever. In those days, 1890, these people were dressed to the nines, weren't they? The ladies were all tricked out in floor length, the beautiful gowns, dresses rather, and parasols, and
it's true, the men as well, they would wear suits, ties, and Sunday best. Even it was a Sunday, but they would have worn the same on a Saturday
to a picnic and a cruise.
They brought their own lunches,
sure.
Many of them. And the women, as you point out, I should mention there were only 57 women and girls on the boat out of the 215 passengers. But the women are all dressed very properly. They all had hats. They had dresses that went up to the neck, down to the wrist, and then gloves. Mm-hmm. And then, then the dresses that came almost down about half an inch off the ground. And then kind of the lace-up shoes that were popular.
You talk about 4 young ladies, probably teenage girls. They decided to go on the cruise. They lived in Red Wing. I think they were boarding, weren't they, at a boarding house?
They were boarding. They were in the Magnuson School of Sewing.
Right. That sounds so quaint, doesn't it?
It does.
So innocent, so nice. So they went unescorted, but felt safe. This
was group.
This was a legitimate, very, very nice outing, and so there wasn't not going to be any hanky-panky going on here. And I think they dressed themselves in their finery, didn't they? Their very best Sunday outfits.
They did. One of the girls said, "This is going to be the event of the season."
Wow. And so they hoped. And a couple of boys who helped load, ice blocks onto the Sea Wing at Red Wing, they were given a reward, or what seemed to be a reward, for their labor. They got to go on the cruise.
They got to go on the cruise without having time to notify their family they were going to do that. The captain said, "You guys have helped a lot, so you can just take the cruise on down. We'll come back we'll be back around 7 or 8 at, tonight.
And your parents will never know. That sort of thing. Well, all right. So the C-Wing takes off and starts cruising down south on the upper Mississippi River and approaches Lake City. And things go off as planned, don't they?
Yeah, I mentioned it was really fine until that windstorm that came through in late afternoon. And that really upset all the schedules. People didn't quite know if the boat was going and when it was going in particular. The captain was on the boat at 6:30, and by 7 he was thinking, I better try to get the people back. And he sounded his whistle, and some people came back, but others didn't hear it.
Mm-hmm. Skies are darkening.
They are darkening.
Storms are approaching.
He has to make the decision, right. And about 7:45 he makes it.
Fred, before we carry this story forward, what about regulations for cruises in those days? Number of life jackets on board? Was there a manifest, a passenger manifest kept? Was there a maximum number allotted to that boat as to how many people could be safely carried? And what about these things?
Those are all good questions, and Washington, D.C. officials wanted to know the answer after the accident. So investigators were sent out to determine that the answers to those questions, taking the life preservers, which were criticized in the press pretty heavily, they had enough, along with some floats, enough required that were required for this amount of people. Although there's some debate about, and I'll get into that in a minute.
Sure.
But also, these were the best life preservers available at the time.
They had the best equipment, and there were enough of them, even for the people, the extra people on the barge?
Well, that became one of the questions, and the inspectors eventually ruled, although he didn't keep a listing, a manifest of passengers, as he was supposed to.
He was supposed to keep a manifest.
Right.
Somebody with the equivalent of a clipboard should have been there at dockside,
sure,
boarded with your name and at, you know, where you're from.
It was a little more informal, and I'm sure, you know, that how we get rules in this country, in fact, around the world, circumstances make changes. And the Sea Wing disaster was a problem that really got some people in Washington thinking we
better
check
this out.
Takes a
tragedy, doesn't it, to get things done right sometimes?
It does, yeah.
Or several tragedies. Right. So, okay, the life preservers were okay then. There were enough of them, and they were of good quality.
Yes.
And no manifest kept. Right?
Correct.
How about maximum number of passengers? Was there such a thing? And if so, did they exceed that?
There was such a thing, and it's very hard to pin down, but the inspectors did. They said the boat was overloaded. The 215 people were too many. The captain argued that before them and said he believed that he was right in taking that many people.
How good was this captain? How seasoned was he, this man David Weatherin?
He knew the river. But it's important to remember that he was also a merchant in Diamond Bluff, and he called himself in census records a merchant, not a captain. Mm. And he hadn't been on the river that much in the early season of 1890. And this was by getting to be mid-season in July now.
Mm-hmm. He was going to sell the boat, wasn't he?
He was. We were only about 5 to 10 years at the most away from the end of logging in the... Mm-hmm. The St. Croix and Mississippi River valleys.
And that's mainly what he did. His boat pushed logs or carried logs.
Right,
or
yep.
Towed them or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm. They call them towing, just like about boats. And they'd go down river and have it processed. So it was a reliable job and something that he could do along with his job as a kind of a mercantile man.
All right. It looked like an excursion boat. It was a stern wheeler, wasn't it?
It was.
The paddle boat on the back, like we see here even on the St. Croix.
The recreation boats that look like that.
So he was a competent captain by all measure,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. So he has to make some pretty difficult calls here as the storm is coming in. He has to get this group of people, 200 plus people, back to Red Wing in that evening. With this big storm bearing down on Lake City, so
he does. And if you think about it, it's very contemporary issue for anybody in charge of some sort of festivity, some program, you know, like a football game where lightning and storms. You know, do we get the people out of the stands for into cover? Do we not? In the boating case like this one, do we decide not to leave? And he decided that he could make the trip, and he left right around 8 o'clock.
Yeah, and again, we can't, it's hard to second-guess the man, because he did not have the benefit of any sort of sophisticated weather forecast or anything like that. He had to look at the sky. He didn't even know about what happened up here with the tornado.
True.
But again, a guy who is running vessels on a river, he has to have some savvy about the weather, and he has to make some pretty critical calls. And I guess you'd want to err on the side of caution, but he apparently thought he could do this.
I think, you know, that's really the central question of the cause of the accident. Should he not have gone out on the river? And as you say, it's easy to second guess now. I think he felt a lot of pressure that he needed to get these people home. Mm-hmm. And he maybe even his own family, he just wanted to do it. Yeah, it's kind of, let's take a little risk here. It's a tiny risk. And you're always thinking about what I said before. You can run it up on land if there's a problem.
You could beach the boat, in other words, right?
Sure.
Okay.
But this is Lake Pepin. It's not the Mississippi at normal width.
No, this is wide.
This is wide, right.
Yes. So if he got in harm's way, there would be trouble, and he had to know that. And so about what time does the Sea Wing finally set sail, as it were? When does it take off from the dock?
They leave right at 8 o'clock.
Okay. And some people opt to not go?
There were some people at the dock there in Lake City who were telling passengers, don't get on. There were others who got on the boat, and in one famous case, when a teenage boy, as the boat pulled out, he looked at the sky, rethought it, jumped overboard, and swam to shore.
About 300 yards.
Yes, it was.
Well, turned out he made a good decision.
Yes,
amazing.
Indeed he did.
All right, so now the Sea Wing is at sea, as it were. It's in the river.
Right.
It's out in the river. And does the captain stay close to shore with this menace heading in toward him?
He does. Do? Yeah. He's doing the right thing. He went along the Wisconsin shore saying he felt that was better protection. The bluffs would give him better protection there. But about an hour upstream, he sees heavy winds blowing off the Minnesota shore. And like a good sailor, turns into them. So at this point, he's going across the Mississippi River, across Lake Pepin. He's not going up it. And as he reaches the middle of this expanse, the winds really kick up, and the barge and the boat are rocking each other. The barge are roped to the Sea Wing. And it's very disturbing to the passengers.
Well, people
on
have
board.
To be in a panic by this time, aren't they?
Yeah, they felt the boat was being pulled apart. And people on the barge felt, this boat's going to roll over on us. It was just getting to be chaotic.
So take us from there.
Okay, well, a couple of the men on the barge tried to chop the ropes holding them to the Sea Wing apart. And while they were doing that, the barge came away from the boat. Now, we don't know if it's because they cut it. But anyway, the barge and boat separated.
Okay.
Sea Wing is drifting one direction, the barge another. Mm-hmm. The people on the barge are watching as the lightning is illuminating the scene. And the Sea Wing is starting to rock on the heavy waves. The barge is, too. Waves were about 4 to 6 feet, and then they were up to 8. And
Ooh.
Some people claim 10-foot
wow.
waves.
Right.
Lake Pepin is rather shallow, so mm-hmm. you can get mm-hmm. some wave action like that.
Mm-hmm.
One of these waves pushed the Sea Wings up to about a 45-degree angle. That's what the eyewitnesses said. And at that point, we realized there has to be water getting into the engine room. And a gust, a straight-line wind, a downburst, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. comes and flips it over, turns it upside down.
The Sea Wing is now upside down.
Upside down. And remember, there are 215 people on board and on the barge. So we think about 80 were on the barge at this time.
If I could interject here, and you make a point of this in your book, before the weather got bad, women on the barge decided to get off the barge and go into the cabin of Sea Wing because some of the guys on the barge had been drinking, they said, and were singing some bawdy ballads, some nasty songs that the women didn't choose to hear. So
exactly.
there were more people, young women, on the Sea Wing than there might have been had this not happened on the barge, where they felt they had to get off because their tender ears were burning from those nasty songs. I mean,
that's true.
It's not funny, but that's what happened.
And there were, of course, other women who stayed on the Sea Wing who went into the cabin for protection from the wind and rain, which makes perfect sense. Some people said the captain ordered that to happen, and I doubt it. I think most of the people just said, it's raining, it's windy, let's get inside.
I'm breaking a sweat on this story, and I've read the whole book. It's just amazing to picture this tragedy, this calamity. It's just amazing. We're going to take a break here. Frederick Johnson is our guest here, author of The Sea Wing Disaster, Tragedy on Lake Pepin in July of 1890. As I've often called it, and many people do, the biggest tragedy in Minnesota and Wisconsin history that many of you have never heard of, and you have heard now for sure, and you'll be hearing more about it. We'll be right back. At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller, great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
There's a lot riding on the rails in Minnesota. Demand for train cars is way up. Demand is so high that Minnesota's agriculture industry is confronted with the prospect of storing this year's harvest on the ground. My name is Brent Stye, and I am a welder for the United Association, Local 798. We build pipelines, and we want to build the Sandpiper Pipeline in northern Minnesota. This will help relieve the pressure on the rail industry, which is shipping crude oil from North Dakota. Local 798 has the best trained, most skilled pipeline workers in the world. We will build the Sandpiper Pipeline to meet the most stringent standards. There is a lot riding on the rails, and a lot riding on a decision made by Minnesota to select a Sandpiper project that works.
Paid for by the United Association of Plumbers, Fitters, Welders, and HVAC Service Techs.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
We are back, an amazing story, a tragic story, the Sea Wing disaster, tragedy on Lake Pepin. This happened, my goodness, 120-some years ago, not too far from the Twin Cities right here on Lake Pepin, that big bulge in the Mississippi River, a July day, a Sunday in 1890, nearly 100 poor souls perished when this excursion boat went down during a vicious storm. The author of the book here, Frederick Johnson, The Sea Wing Disaster, Tragedy on Lake Pepin. Fred Johnson is with us here. Fred, just a second ago, we were talking off air about applying a label to this disaster. I said it's probably the most famous disaster that folks around here have never heard of, and I think there's some truth in that. But also other people have said it's our Titanic in a way, too. I mean, the scale of the disasters are obviously quite apart, but from one another in terms of lives lost. But nevertheless, this is a very big deal here. The town of Red Wing especially suffered mightily from this.
Yes.
Most of the dead came from Red Wing.
That's
here.
True.
All right, so we when we left the story here, the excursion boat, the Sea Wing, has now been turned over, capsized in Lake Pepin, the bulge in the Mississippi River. And, of course, the boat is full of people. What happens next?
Well, let's remember we were talking about the women and a number of the men as well went into the cabin for protection from the storm. So as the boat started to tip, you can see exactly what would happen. The people would start to fall. And as it rolled, they're falling towards the wall, and pretty soon they're upside down, underwater, and trapped. It's a death trap. And virtually no one.
The captain, too, doesn't it?
The captain is in the wheelhouse, and we know the wheelhouse was 22, the boat was 22 feet high. He was 20 feet under the water. And he managed to push out the window of the pilot house and escape and get up on the bottom of the boat. But everyone in the cabin drowned, and there were a couple of people by the door that escaped and survived. So you think, well, here's the story. It's over. But what about the other people thrown into the water, the people on the bottom of the boat, the people on the barge? The barge drifted near shore, and some of the Lake City boys on the barge, teenagers, jumped out and waded ashore and ran to Lake City to notify the town. The town had been clobbered by this wind, too. So people were up and around, and they rushed down to the Washington Street Pier, and you can now see the Sea Wing has drifted downriver about 3 miles from where it rolled over.
Upside down.
So you can see it from Lake City. You can see the wreckage.
Now this operation, sad to say, turned from a rescue operation rather quickly to a recovery operation. And folks, you know what I mean by that. They couldn't rescue anybody. They were drowned, most of those people.
Most of them were, exactly.
Now, there was a riverboat captain in Lake City who was told about the tragedy and asked to get his craft out there right away to help save some of these people, and he refused to go out.
Yeah, John Howard, and he was the captain of the Ethel Howard, and he said, "I just put more people in the lake." Meaning he felt the boat couldn't stand
his boat would go
his
down
boat.
Too.
Yeah, but there were about six boats that were rowed out, six rowboats by Lake City men who were incredible bravery.
Wow!
Went through that storm. There was hail falling by this time, and they went out there and they did find two or three people in the water that survived.
What time of day is this, Fred?
It's now about 10 o'clock.
Daylight's gone, pretty much.
Daylight has gone, and there was no daylight savings time, so it was fairly dark at 8, and then throw the storm in there. It was quite dark.
Yeah, all right.
So they send word to the National Guard, and by midnight, as you say, they're recovering there. The Sea Wing bumps into Central Point and then rolls to its side, which actually exposes part of the cabin, and they're able to begin at midnight chopping holes in the roof of the cabin and taking bodies out.
The folks back in Red Wing, whose relatives and friends were on the boat, how soon were they notified of this disaster?
It depends on who you were and where you were. Some of the farm families didn't get notified at all. All they knew is that their loved ones weren't back. A train went up to Red Wing around 3 a.m, and word started to spread. Obviously, people were alert to something was terribly wrong, and they all knew that the storm had hit Red Wing, too. And it rolled fields of corn flat. You know, it was, everybody knew if the Sea Wing was on the water, they would be in trouble.
What time was the Sea Wing due back in Red Wing?
They thought it would be back about 10 o'clock, but that was starting at 7. He started later than the time that he actually...
So we have the grim recovery, and this is grim. We have a hot, humid day. I'm not going to go into the details of what you would expect to find once you're starting to take these bodies out of the river, but it was pretty bad.
The first night, those bodies were in decent shape. They had drowned. We have a remarkable photographic record of this accident from the beginning to the end, and I know you've seen the photos. But also, we had a St. Paul Dispatch reporter who was on the scene. He was on the Ethel Howard, which is now taking bodies back to Red Wing.
So that captain finally did go out.
He went out
when
there.
He felt it was safe.
Yes.
He might have been right not to go out right away. Huh?
He might have been.
Who knows?
You know,
we don't know.
Right. But when he showed up at Red Wing at 6 the next morning, there were 52 bodies on the barge, on the boat, and you can imagine the scene at the Red Wing levee. Mm-hmm. There were all sorts of townspeople that had no idea if they were going to be looking at the body of their loved one or find them somehow alive or no word at all.
The cover, the dust jacket of your book, The Sea Wing Disaster, Tragedy on Lake Pepin. I've never seen a cover of a book quite like this one. Please describe it.
Well, if you just grab the book and look at it, you'll see a bunch of photographs assembled in some sort of order, and actually it's photographs of almost every one of the 98 Sea Wing victims. A Red Wing photographer asked the families...
In life, I should say.
Except
for one.
Right. Okay. Except for one. But he asked people who had relatives and family on the boat, if they had a photograph, bring them to him. And he arranged them and then took a photograph of the photographs.
So a composite of all the victims we see here.
Right, and again, we talk about how good the record is. All of these are studio photos. It's clear that they're, you know, you don't have even the brownies weren't invented yet, so they reproduce very well.
Our hour is running so fast here. We've got to get, obviously, there is the inevitable investigation. The government right. steps in here. They hold hearings. I think in St. Paul, just right. days after the tragedy, there are funerals going on in Red Wing and elsewhere, right?
Yes.
How many funerals and how many days down in Red Wing? It's just amazing. Well,
remember, the accident was on Sunday. On Tuesday, there were 44 funerals in Red Wing.
Oh, my Lord.
Just...
And
amazing.
Almost as soon, as fast, there were investigators on the scene and convening a full-scale official investigation in St. Paul. And, of course, the captain who survived, David Weatherin, he testifies, and all the other principals who survived do, too, passengers and the rest. What happens? What do the investigators find out? What do they conclude?
The investigators arrived on the scene in Lake City just as the last bodies were being recovered. They were not all recovered until Thursday. The bodies recovered on Wednesday, where, as you were talking about, bodies in bad condition. I've not found one account that says a body was recognizable. They were all only recognizable mm-hmm. by mm-hmm. clothing. So the inspectors conduct their investigation, and we kind of alluded to the fact that they disagreed with the captain and the number of people he had on board. They found him guilty of recklessness in starting out in the face of a storm. Mm-hmm. And the captain, of course, suffered greatly. He lost his wife and youngest son.
Yeah, that they were on the boat?
They were right there with him, and you can imagine he's got the guilt of, you know, of what has happened.
And he's found guilty by an official tribunal of recklessness, of reckless behavior as a captain.
Yeah, you know, it's just a deserved finding, I believe, but... this is a terrible, terrible tragedy.
What punishment besides the emotional punishment? Does he serve any time in jail? Is he fined? What happens to the captain?
The people who came from Washington were investigators. They weren't prosecutors. They recommended and sent the information they collected. They sent that forward to the federal attorney in St. Paul and recommended prosecution. But the captain was never prosecuted.
Why?
You know... I've always thought, perhaps people thought he suffered enough.
Mm-hmm. There were threats against him.
There were threats right off the bat, right down at, because he was down there watching like other people were at Central Point on Monday morning and Tuesday morning while the bodies were still being taken.
He had to be the most hated man in Red Wing among some people.
I would think so. You can understand people's grief and anger.
Sure. Sure, absolutely. But this man, Captain David Weatherin, would not only escape formal punishment, but he would become part of the fabric of society in Red Wing, wouldn't he?
Did he
serve on some government boards?
He was a Diamond Bluff guy, you're right, he came to Red Wing and was a Mason and a member of the Masonry in Red Wing and in Diamond Bluff, and he was a city councilman. In Diamond Bluff, always a civic leader.
And he lived into the 1920s, I think. And mind you, this tragedy happened in 1890.
Right.
And one of his sons went on to become a riverboat captain, didn't he?
Right, Roy Weatherin. When doing the original research on this in the 1980s, people still knew Roy Weatherin.
What came out of this tragedy in the way of enhanced or increased safety measures when it came to cruising on rivers, on excursion boats?
I studied a number of different records, including the progression of life jacket improvements. There weren't many changes there. There were restrictions put on the number of people you could carry on a boat, and more explicit. Somebody said, well, would it have been okay if there were two barges on the bow, make it more stable? Mm-hmm. You know, that had to be ironed out and put in, codified, so people could actually say, this is right, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. Those are the biggest things, and remember, these accidents were... This is terribly rare to have a riverboat capsize, to have weather cause an accident because mm-hmm. of the reasons I've stated. You were so close to shore, you could usually avoid mm-hmm. that problem.
Let's not forget the individuals here. Some families lost. Well, the one family you write of, you write about quite a few of them, the Peter Gerken family of Red Wing.
Right, he was a saloon owner, and he and his wife Maria were on board with all six of their children, and they all drowned. Entire family. There were other families lost, but that was the biggest. There were fiancés, you know, on board right before getting married. They were lost. They're some of the girls we heard about, the Steiger sisters. You remember that story?
Yeah.
Were held on. Their boyfriends were with them. They had them by the arm. They had them by the clothes. They finally had them by the hair. And then finally lost their grip in the rugged waves of Lake Pepin.
And they were the girls... were lost.
The girls drowned.
You know, you have an entire listing here of those who died. Just looking at the ages, this is heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking.
It
I'm
is.
Just going to randomly go down the line here. John Adams, age 19. Alexander Anderson, age 25. Charles Brown, age 14. Another 19-year-old, 21. These are mostly young people, just young people. They're just... Oh.
In the bloom of life,
yes,
starting out,
yes.
And there were some older folk
sure.
on board too, but a majority were younger.
Tell us more about some of the victims, Fred.
Well, I think about the Steiger sisters who I had mentioned, but the one that really grabs me is Eliza Crawford, who was a teacher near Red Wing, who was lost and. And I literally mean lost because her body wasn't found. And she kind of represents those who weren't in the cabin or were in the cabin and not found. We have a letter that her uncle wrote back. She was from Ohio, back to the family in Ohio, saying, I haven't sent a telegram because I thought we'd find her. And we haven't found her yet, and we don't know if we'll ever find her. You know, that's the kind of the tone of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a troubled terrible thing to have to write.
And in your book, you have a photograph, I think of a telegram, from one relative saying,
right.
Come home, all five of our relatives are drowned.
The Merrow family, right, from Diamond Bluff. What a terrible deal. This woman was home when the accident struck. It caused a fire in their barn, killed all their horses. Then it killed her husband and her two children who still lived at home. Mm-hmm. And it was an older brother who sent the telegram saying, come at once.
What a story you tell. It's a tragedy. I'm glad somebody of your competence has told it. It needs to be out there. You're an author. You've written other books. The Big Water about Lake Minnetonka, the history
yes.
of. Are there any tragedies of maybe not of this magnitude, but heavy loss of life on Lake Minnetonka?
There's a Lake Minnetonka accident, a drowning that... It kind of hits like this, the Rand family, Alonzo Rand, a former mayor, 10 people drown in a Sunday afternoon accident that is reminiscent.
When was that?
1885.
Boy. Well, again, congratulations on a great job. What else do you have in the world? I hope you're going to write some more books. you enlighten us in a way we need to be.
I've done lots of histories. I'm working on putting together a history of my years in education. In inner city St. Paul, you know a little bit about that, the area where I taught, which became a feature story for the Washington Post, the poster child.
Really?
For the class of 2000, I still remember this.
They did,
on the front page of the Washington Post, they came to our school.
Really?
To predict what would happen in 2000. And they were talking about demographics. It's a fascinating story because they were right on.
You were the teacher then?
I was a teacher in that school over 1,000 children.
And
big
their,
school.
Their story was to find out what would happen to these kids by the year 2000?
It was 1988, right.
Yeah,
so then,
yeah.
What would happen, how the new class would look, the incoming class of 2000 would look.
Amazing. I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah,
that
I think
like
it's
a good deal.
Online.
Well, Frederick Johnson, please continue writing. You're a marvelous storyteller, a great researcher, and we thank you very much for coming along. Kyle, how much time do we have left here? Are we just about out? 1 minute left. Well, we've got some great weather going here, as I told you before. Looking good all the way through the week. By Thursday, we could be in the low 70s here in the metro area. 71 is the predicted high. Sunny skies Thursday. Let's see, Wednesday sunny. Yep, Tuesday sunny. Going backwards here. Monday, rain likely on the holiday, than otherwise cloudy skies. 57 on Monday. So once again, our thanks to Frederick L. Johnson, author of The Sea Wing Disaster, Tragedy on Lake Pepin. And Fred, this should be available. If it's not in the bookstore that you walk into, just ask them to order it, right?
Exactly.
And they can get it. Okay, hardbound and an excellent job. Thank you so much for coming up here. We appreciate it
very much. I appreciate being here.
Well, folks, if you're at loose ends for something to do, come on down to Stillwater this weekend. There are giant pumpkins, great pumpkins, and all kinds of fun goings-on for the autumnal season. So come on down and indulge. Have fun. Otherwise, we'll plan to see you on Monday at noon for the All Request and Dedication program right here on Club 1220 KLBB. Bye-bye.